It's bird news the first Saturday of the month when we give click and clack the day off. I'm Mindy Todd along with ornithologist Vernon Locks. Morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy.
Well, last weekend, wet, cool, windy. This weekend, gorgeous weather, a little bit different. But are we still seeing any migrating birds flying in?
It was really too bad, the Memorial Day weekend weather, because, you know, Memorial Day, the kickoff of the summer, everybody's on vacation. It's traditionally one of the best weekends of the entire year for birds, and it was a big washout on Saturday and Sunday. Monday, Memorial Day itself, actually the wind cleared from the northwest. It was sunny and windy, but there were some, all of a sudden, birds started appearing in places. There were a couple of Mississippi kites up in North Truro at the Hawk Watch that Don Manchester sighted. These are tropical birds, basically, that have been, anyway, very rare, very great to see them. The next day, on Tuesday, there were some summer tanagers and a yellow-throated warbler that dropped in over on Nantucket. And then, basically, everyone's been complaining about how slow it is for migrant birds. On Thursday, it was a southwest wind, a little bit of haze and fog. There was a massive flight of birds at Thursday night. The nocturnal migration was very impressive. You could see it on the NEXRAD radars coming right up the East Coast. The outer islands, at least Nantucket, got nothing. The Outer Cape got very little. Manomet Bird Observatory, or the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences over in Plymouth, Manomet Point, they have a series of mist nets, these little fine nets that birds run into, and you catch them and you band them. And they had the largest flight of flycatchers they've ever experienced in their, like, 45 years of banding. It was incredible. They had over 70 small Impidnax flycatchers come in. It was absolutely shocking how many birds they had. And these Impidnax are like the definition of a confusing bird. They're a tiny little green flycatcher with eye ring, wing bars, and they all look the same.
So you can't tell the males from the females.
Even when you're banding them, and you can actually measure the length of various feathers, because sometimes the difference is the sixth primary has an emargination. They were so busy they couldn't actually separate some of them to species. They just put bands on them and called them all trails and let them go. But it was these flycatchers are only separable when they're on their breeding grounds, where they separate by habitat, and when they're calling. So when they're in migration, if they're not calling, it's like a little green job. And anyway, it was fantastic.
And
today is June 1st.
Yeah, but you said they migrate at night?
Almost all the land birds. Every warbler, sparrow, finch, they are nocturnal migrants.
Huh.
Reasons for this? If you think of a little bird... I'm actually flying here. You can't see it in the studio.
You got a big wingspan.
Right. there's a whole number of reasons. One of the big reasons is they're safe from fast-flying falcons in the daytime. They're out in the daytime. They get caught over the water. They're easy pickings for merlins and peregrines. Also, it's very hot in the daytime. Like today, if they were flying, the little birds are able to double their body weight. In the spring, not so much, but they put on enough fat in a subcutaneous layer that they are then able to metabolize. They use it just like gasoline. Imagine if you look at me, if I could double my body weight in 2 weeks, which would just be a horrifying sight, I would put it on everywhere. The birds can actually do this and then utilize that fat just like gas flying, and they go on these long nonstop flights. If they're flying at night, of course, half the bird's body weight is in its two pectoral, its breast muscles to power its wings. And the byproduct of that is all this heat from all the exercise. They're exercising incredibly, breathing in and out. So they respirate out cool moisture, which is a byproduct of breaking down the fat, and they get rid of excess heat. At night, it's much cooler.
Much cooler. Right? So, but once they get to where they're going, they don't fly at night anymore, right?
No.
Only migration.
Only migration.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Once they get to where they're going, they turn into normal birds again.
Right.
But how they do it is fascinating.
That is fascinating. Yeah. So we've got a lot of migrants already here, built their nests, we're seeing lots of little baby birds. And this is the time of year we get a lot of questions about baby birds.
Right. It's so amazing because still the birds that breathe the furthest north right now, actually, we're sort of peaking the shorebird migration. The birds that nest up on the Arctic tundra black-bellied plovers, sanderlings, ruddy turnstones, yellow legs. They actually breed a little further south. They are still passing through. Like, if we could go to South Beach, Monomoy today, that there would be really incredible numbers of birds. And the horseshoe crabs are also spawning. Mm. And the horseshoe crab eggs are just like little energy. It's like a protein bar for these shorebirds. And they come in and they're full of fat and they eat as many of them. And that'll take them from here, their final 2,500 miles north to where they're going to breed.
Right.
But meanwhile, the robins that are here, the house finches, the Carolina chickadees, they've already laid eggs, have babies, and many of them are already working on a second brood.
Yeah.
So there's baby birds everywhere right now.
And just because you see a baby bird hopping around in the yard does not mean it's lost its parents. Leave it alone, right?
Absolutely. Well, you know. Keep going. That's good. I want to go ahead.
Because mom and dad are watching, or mom anyway.
Right. If you think of, let's talk about, everybody knows what an American robin is. Generally, they almost always lay four robin's egg blue eggs.
Pretty eggs.
They're beautiful. Yeah. They lay the eggs. They incubate, I think it's like 18 days. And then the adults go into this massive, they feed them. And they outgrow the nest in about, anyway, they'll fledge in 14 to 18 days. So 2 to 3 weeks, and the baby birds leave the nest, but they can't fly yet. Their feathers aren't fully. They sort of hop around. They call them branchers. And so the adults stay in contact with the birds and still feed them, but it's all audio. Mm. They recognize each other's calls. So the adult will come in somewhere, and the baby chick will call, and the adult will go over and feed it. And this will go on until the baby fledges and can fly, and then they're on their own.
And, of course, sometimes you'll have some types of birds who will be putting up a big fuss if you're getting too close to the baby. So if a bird is, like, squawking at you and flying near you, you get away because you're probably near its babies.
Absolutely. Blue jays, crows. Now, blue jays.
Terns.
Terns
will attack you.
On the beach, yeah. If you're anywhere on the beach and a bird is coming after you, then clearly you have strayed where you should not be.
Yeah.
Should try to get out of there. And really, I mean, I love dogs and stuff, but a bird on the beach, a nesting least tern, a common tern, a piping plover, it doesn't matter if the dog is on a leash even. They recognize that. I mean, as far as they're concerned, that's a coyote or a wolf or a fox, and it's a big threat to them. And they go berserk. And if they're up there going crazy trying to chase you and your dog off the beach, the eggs, if they haven't hatched, may fry in the sun. Mm. The little chick will get cooked. It's just really a poor idea to take your dog to the beach right now for the bird's sake.
So, for the bird's sake, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So what are some of the other do's and don'ts when we talk about baby birds?
Oh, it's just, just common sense is the best thing.
Yeah.
But basically, if birds, these are wild animals, they're wild birds, and any contact, if they get acclimated to humans, it can only work against the bird's favor. So, and a bird has a much better chance of surviving if you basically just get out of there and leave it alone. Right. The adults know where they are. They will feed them. They'll defend them as best they can. Of course, if you have house cats, or hopefully you keep them in the house, they're a brutal predator on young birds.
Yeah.
And, anyone that I would encourage people if they – I love cats too. But
keep them inside.
Keep them in
right
the
now.
House.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's an email we have from Cindy. I have had the pleasure of watching a robin's nest at home. It's so close to the house, I don't even need my webcam. Three eggs hatched last Saturday. The male stands guard over the nest while the female is out feeding and gathering food for the young. I've seen him chase off crows, blue jays, and grackles from the area. He feeds the young too. I've also put out mealworms. Only the female's been eating them. In the last few days, she now is feeding the young with these worms. What a sight to see 10 to 14 worms in her beak. How does she not drop any? I've learned a lot about robin behavior and just want to say even our common birds are worth watching. Thanks for this great show, Cindy.
Yeah. Great email.
Yeah.
As to how they don't drop the 14 mealworms in their beak, I have no idea. That's amazing.
Lots of practice.
I always pick, you see the pictures of different alcids, like the puffins, with like 12 fish, 12 little capelin lined up in its beak. And how do they do that?
Yeah, I know. You know what? She's right, though, about what you can learn watching this. As you know, a couple of years in a row, I've had a house finch nest right outside my front door. And I really love watching when they take that first leap, and they've just leave it. Like they're sitting there, shall I go?
The moment of fledging is the moment of truth.
It's awesome.
I always love to see a baby, an osprey, take its first flight.
Oh, right.
Or a red-tailed
hawk. You've got a good, where you're at on Nantucket, you've got a great
I saw an osprey last week. actually catch. I've never seen it before. I've heard about it. It dove in with one tail, it grabbed two fish on the same
wow.
with one foot
yeah.
with the four claws, and it got yeah. and it couldn't. Of course, normally they would turn the fish around because they have this what do I want to say, reversible, like our thumb,
right?
And they can turn a fish so that it's always head first. It couldn't do that
because
it
had
two fish wiggling. So it actually flew up and landed on this hillside. And Dre, that was funny.
All right. Our bird brain quiz has to do with babies, baby birds. And the question is, how have baby birds evolved to deal with fecal waste that does not contaminate the nest? So that's our bird brain quiz. If you think you know the answer and you want to chime in, you can give us a call at 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@wgbh.org.
Can you do yeah. that again? That was a little confusing
okay,
to me.
Okay, how have baby birds evolved to deal with fecal waste so it does not contaminate the nest?
All right. Excellent.
Okay. That's the question. Now, each year, the Massachusetts Audubon Society holds a fundraising event called the Birdathon. It's a friendly competition among teams of Mass Audubon birders from across the state. They fan out at various sites to see who can spot the most bird species in a 24-hour period. Donors pledge money based on the number and diversity of species observed. And this year, the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary team was made up of young birders from local middle and high schools. Cape Cod birder Peter Troll led the group as they walked to Beach Forest Trail in Provincetown last month, and our reporter Brian Morris tagged along.
It's 8:30 on a recent sunny Saturday morning. I meet up with Peter Troll and the Birdathon team at the Beach Forest area parking lot.
I want to walk down this trail to the far corner, and I want to go at a bit of a pace, okay? I mean, we'll look for stuff.
The trail skirts the edge of a large pond. Along the way, the group will try to spot as many bird species as they can.
Great crested flycatcher singing over there, you guys. Here, that's the white throat calling. Listen to this song, you'll hear it go. Listen. Listen.
These kids have come prepared. They wear field binoculars around their neck, and I find myself wishing I had a pair when they all suddenly aim up toward the trees at an elusive bird.
What are you looking at, Joe?
Kingbirds.
Oh, mockingbird.
Yeah, those are kingbirds.
They're on a branch.
Most of these young birders have a keen ability to spot birds on far-off branches or in thickets, and they listen intently for different calls. They already possess that heightened awareness that serious birding seems to imbue in people, and they don't seem the least bit self-conscious about pursuing a hobby that some of their peers might find a bit uncool. Joey Benedict is a senior at Sturgis Charter School in Hyannis.
You never really know what you're going to see. I've been doing this for a couple years now, and we usually go looking for things such as warblers, and last year we found a sandhill crane, which we totally weren't looking for. So you're full of surprises when you come here.
Okay, I think the bird on the left is a chipping sparrow.
Are they both chippers?
Yeah.
Yep, the one on the right's a chippy.
Caleb Levesque attends Veritas Academy in Centerville.
Did you see that last bird?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
It was a chipping sparrow.
Is that kind of an unusual bird, or is that...
That is kind of unusual, but yeah. It is pretty common around here in Massachusetts.
What do you like most about doing this?
I like how we can see birds and really get a good look at them.
You learn a lot about their habitats and all that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody try to see this toy. It's a beautiful black and white bird with rusty sides. That's the male singing.
One of the youngest in the group is Keith Gagnon. He's already an accomplished birder and has a bird feather collection on exhibit at the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary.
How old are you, Keith?
6 and a half.
Yeah. What do you like about doing this? Well, let me ask you this. Are you hoping to see any particular bird today?
Keith is a bit mic shy, but his mother, Kim, says birding is in his heart.
You just really can't get enough of birding, and you can't help but fall in love with birds through Keith's eyes.
What do you get out of it?
I just get the enjoyment of watching Keith be so enthralled by something so special. It's just so wonderful to see somebody so actively engaged in nature and conservation, hopefully for the future.
Nearby, Kalia Trudeau surveys the trees for movement. She says she's always been close to nature.
I live on Harwich Conservation Area, and I figured, like, what a better chance to get to really know all the species in my backyard. So that's really why I'm here.
Her friend Maeve Noonprice says she enjoys learning about the various bird species.
There's so many different types of birds that you could see. My favorite bird would probably be a kingbird. I like kingbirds. They're cool.
How do you guys learn how to recognize all these species?
Well, once you really see one, you can never forget it. It's just like when I first saw a towhee, it's such a beautiful bird, you can't possibly forget its name. Like, how can you?
How many different bird species do you think you could recognize right offhand? A whole bunch? Or?
20 to 30, like between common and rare, I think I could identify a few.
Could you identify them from their calls or from their looks?
I'm more of a looks person, not the calls, but I know some like more common calls like goldfinch and the robin and stuff like that.
Red-winged blackbird, of course.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's hard to miss that one, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
As we continue on, Peter Troll points out something I hadn't noticed.
The titmice and chickadees just follow people around here.
And so they were. Several chickadees flitted from branch to branch just behind our group.
I think the local folks here in Provincetown have trained them to feed in an open hand. So a lot of times when you're standing here talking or birding, you'll have three or four chickadees within arm's length of your head saying, "Are you going to feed me or not?"
Soon, a couple of kids return with bird seed in their hands. Standing motionless, they hold their arms out straight, and sure enough, a chickadee sitting on a nearby branch flies over and lands on Kalia Trudeau's outstretched hand. It takes some seed, then quickly flies off.
So what does that feel like?
It's just like tiny little feet touching your hand. It's really weird.
Do you have to sort of really just stay still so you don't spook them?
Like totally.
Yeah. The chestnut side has just called again. Listen, goes, please, 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 please to meet ya.
For all the lively bird songs around us, Peter Troll says this month has been relatively quiet.
We've had a lot of east winds. We had about 10 days of hard east, and that's just not going to produce a lot of migrants. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing today here are a lot of the local nesters, the orioles, the great crested flycatchers, the pine warblers, the chipping sparrows.
That means many birds that otherwise would be here are showing up in the western parts of the state. But it can be a completely different story with winds from the southwest.
We can just have birds just piling up in the beech forest, and sometimes you come here in some years and it's just seemingly dripping with birds, but not this year. It's been a very quiet year.
So how do you keep track of every species you see in terms of the competition? How do you know, like, well, we saw this many and they saw that many?
Well, generally there's a list that you go down. Some people use an electronic site called eBird, which gives you all the Massachusetts possibilities. Okay. So at the end of the day, we'll just go down the list and check off, you know, 4 catbirds, 7 orioles, and so on.
Back at the parking lot at the end of the one-mile trek, Peter Troll is already planning where the group will head next.
I think we'll probably take a ride through the Heron Cove beach area.
Okay.
Can Miles ride with us?
The kids pile into a blue van, off again in search of that rare species, that once-in-a-lifetime Holy Grail sighting. It is, after all, what every birder lives for. For Bird News, I'm Brian Morris along the Beech Forest Trail in Provincetown.
And Vern, you took part in that. Your team, I guess, outperformed all the other teams, right?
I just want to say about that piece that, ladies and gentlemen, is our future.
Oh, absolutely.
I love hearing that's those kids. I'm proud of That's great. That's a whole new.
Yeah.
It opens a whole nother world all over the world. And that without getting young people involved and looking at birds and conservation and just birding can start you on the path to so many good things.
Absolutely.
That was just, I like that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So tell us about your team.
The Birdathon was started. It's a fundraiser. You know, all the money, each sanctuary. I went out for Wellfleet Bay, which I've done for a while because I like Wellfleet Bay and the people there, and they're doing a lot of nice educational outreach stuff. I had a team. I had the Trimble boys. I had Peter and Jeremiah over on Nantucket. And Nantucket, while not great for species diversity, in other words, we could have gone out to Western Mass and seen 170 species of birds instead of the 24 hours we worked on Nantucket. I think we ended up with 125, 130 species. But a lot of what we saw was not seen by any other team anywhere in the state. Mm. Things like barn owl, we had merlins, There was a whole series of birds that we've got the only ones for for the sanctuary, which helped get the total up there and made more money for the sanctuary.
That's great. You know, in Brian's piece, we heard from little Keith Gagnon, who we've talked about his feather collection a couple. And I have to say, he's really not that shy usually.
it sounded like he might have been a little intimidated.
He was thinking, he's so adorable. But
he was probably the youngest person
there, wasn't he?
So all the big kids were looking at him, maybe. And anyway, that's all right, Keith. Don't worry about it.
He's great.
That's good.
And feeding the chickadees from the hand, that must have been really exciting for those kids.
That is. It's very exciting. I don't know that it's a great thing, but chickadees.
They're curious.
No, but chickadees, I'm just thinking, comparing a chickadee to a human is like comparing a three-toed sloth to a Galapagos tortoise. We don't even exist in the chickadee. We are so
slow.
And so they could come in and land on our hand 10 times before you could pull it away. Everything about them, that's just, and up there they have learned people walk around with sunflower seeds, and it's a big source of food for the chickens.
Right. So
I've been up there in the spring, and I've seen it happen a lot a little earlier, because chickadees nest in cavities, and they line their nests with sphagnum moss and different hairs and stuff. They'll come and land on your head and start pulling the hair out to use the nest. It's funny. The chickadee will be on your head, try to get hair to come out. It's very funny. Mm. It tickles.
If you have a bird question for us, a bird story, or you want to try to answer our bird brain quiz question, give us a call at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email seems to have gone out at the moment, so no email right now. 866-999-4626. And our bird brain quiz was, how have baby birds evolved to deal with fecal waste so that it does not contaminate the nest? If you think you know, give us a call. So, Vern, we want to talk a little bit about the muted swans. We've been hearing from a lot of folks who are saying
mute swans.
All right, sorry.
I wish they were muted.
Yeah. And they've got their little, what do you call them, cygnets, the little baby ones?
The cygnets,
So people are telling us that they're seeing a lot of cygnets and they're wondering about these beautiful birds, but they're beautiful, but they're not native to this area.
Tell us
the history.
How can you not like, a little cygnet, or it's like a baby duckling or a little swan? What could be better looking than that? But people say, aren't the swans beautiful? And I'm afraid I'm a bit of a contrarian. Yes, they are beautiful. But the more you learn about mute swans and how they got here and why they're here, it may change your opinion of them. And they're actually a really big pest in most areas. Mute swans are native to Europe and Asia. In Europe, the only people that could have mute swans, just to back up a little, in the early 1900s, if we were living on Cape Cod in 1925, we would have probably chickens. We'd have a small pond. We'd also be keeping some ducks that would be for food, mallards and domestic ducks. And so everybody kept waterfowl collections, everybody. And down around New York City, sort of the captains of Wall Street, the wealthiest people on the Hudson River and big estates on the west end of Long Island would have these big waterfowl collections, and they would have mute swans. It's like a mute swan would be like having the top of the, like having a Ferrari in your waterfowl collection, in your car collection. Ducks and geese and swans grow new flight feathers once a year. So the gameskeepers, if they breed in the summer and then they molt and they grow a whole, they actually cannot fly for up to 6 weeks, some of these birds, when they drop all their feathers. The gameskeepers, when they grow new feathers, would cut them so that the swans and the stuff wouldn't fly away. So they didn't need to cage them because they couldn't fly anywhere and they would stay. Well, then the Great Depression hit and people lost everything. And especially people that had the most money lost the most stuff, and they couldn't pay their gameskeepers and they lost their house. And the gameskeepers didn't have the heart. Nobody wanted to kill the swans, so they just let everything go. Well, time went by. The swans grew their feathers out again, and they started moving. They moved up the Hudson River. They started moving up Long Island, because remember, these are native to Europe and Asia. We do have native swans called tundra swans, and they used to be very common in this area in the winter. No longer.
Mm.
The mute swans spread. They're also amazingly big. Mute swans can weigh up to 65 pounds.
Wow.
They're one of the heaviest flying birds in the world. They spread up Long Island. The first mute swans got to Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket in, wait for it, 1960.
Wow.
There were no swans here except native swans. And then they kept spreading north and east. They're very aggressive. They don't migrate. In the winter when the ponds freeze, they only go as far west as they have to. And they also, because they're such big birds, they tip up and they eat the underwater vegetation. And unlike our native swans, which clip it off, the mute swans actually pull it out by the roots.
Oh, boy.
Which causes all the water quality, putrefaction of the ponds, like carp have caused a lot of damage. Well, mute swans are just as bad or worse. Anyway, they've spread. There used to be a mosquito-borne encephalitis that would kill them when they got north of Boston. They are now many states. They spread now. Delaware has taken action. Game wardens in Vermont, there are no mute swans. The game wardens shoot them on sight up there. There are none on Lake Champlain because of what they would, you know, there's a whole bunch. In fact, now there's a lot of states trying to control the swans because of the problem. So they are beautiful and stuff, but it's a man-made problem we created.
Yeah.
And I don't know what needs to, something really should be done to.
But we don't know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Anyway, okay. So that's all it right. About mute swans.
That's the history.
Not to go all negative all right. On everything.
Let's go talk to Jeff, who's calling from Nantucket. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good
morning.
I just got to say, Vern, you've made a bird watcher out of me, man.
Great.
I get up, I play with the birds singing every morning. I got a question for you. We saw the tiniest little woodpecker for about 3 minutes 2 days ago, eating with the finches, and I can't identify it. I have no idea what it was. It looked like it was all black and white. Could it be a downy, or what might we have seen?
It should be. In fact, the only small woodpecker that is possible, really, would be a downy woodpecker.
Okay.
And they're very
so
small.
So beautiful. And it took a look at the house finches and bolted.
Yeah. They'll eat sunflower seeds. They like suet. There's a lot of baby woodpeckers just fledging right now. Somebody sent me a picture of a couple of young woodpeckers that were obviously just out of the nest. They still had some down, and they actually must have been nesting in an oak tree because they had some brown stains on their chest from the tannins in the oaks. And anyway, I'm delighted to hear you're looking at birds.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, it's every morning, hours. We got feeders everywhere. Very
oh, it just
so
gets
much.
Better. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the phone call.
Sure, take care.
All right. Larry's giving us a call from Eastham. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Question about orioles. We are fortunate enough to have orioles nesting again here in the property, and we put out oranges right outside the window, and we see the male come down, which is very bright orange and black with a black head. We see the female occasionally, which doesn't have a totally black head, but then we see these others, there seem to be a couple of them, that are like colored like the male, but much duller. They have a black head, and they just have overall dull plumage.
Would you call them orange or sort of?
Too soon for them to be juveniles, and I just wondered what they are.
Well, I would if they come out to an orange. Is there any way you can get photos of them, digital?
Yeah, I could. Yeah,
that would be great. It sounds to me like you have a nesting pair of orioles, adults. And then you've got some juvenile males in the area that are just sort of floaters, and they're coming in to eat the oranges.
Yeah.
So what happens
here or from this year?
Yeah. Do you have a big locust trees in your yard?
Yes.
Are they nesting in the locust?
I think actually they're nesting in a kind of a pear tree, a fruit tree. It doesn't really bear much fruit, but it's
right.
Next to the locust. It's almost as tall as the locust.
Take a look in a field guide at orchard oriole.
I did. I actually have seen orchard orioles here before.
Uh-huh.
But this is not that.
Right. Orchard orioles are a little bit smaller. They're differently colored. They're sort of greenish yellow, not orange yellow.
I haven't seen that this year. This seems like a not quite fully developed male oriole, but I just wondered, you know, it seemed like they should be at that stage for this year's young.
Yeah. No, it sounds like they're not going. They're not breeding. They're just hanging in the area. Maybe they were last year's young. It's hard to say. But
last year's, yeah.
It's interesting because all bird populations, like Rob's, they have every morning that oriole gets up before you do, probably, and sings. Usually their territories actually have four corners. And they get up every morning and they sing from that spot and they proclaim their existence. And then the other orioles know that this territory is occupied. Well, say that oriole has a really rotten day today and a Cooper's hawk, somehow he's going down for some oranges and a Cooper's hawk gets him. Well, tomorrow morning or tonight when he's supposed to sing, there's no song coming from there and there's no song tomorrow morning. And one of those young males that's floating in the thing will take his place
take
very
spot,
quickly.
Yeah.
That's how these populations are maintained.
It's Larry, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Still no answer to the bird brain quiz. How have baby birds evolved to deal with fecal waste so that does not contaminate the nest? We've got an email from Janet in Wellfleet who says, just a moment ago, I heard a clip from the show you're airing this hour featuring a boy with a lot of bird knowledge. In the clip, he says something about a towhee being such a beautiful bird that you'll never forget it. I've been seeing a lovely little bird around that I hadn't identified. I didn't even know what category of bird to search. The moment I heard that clip, I Googled towhee, and indeed, that's exactly what it was. How funny is that? That's great.
What's funny is the internet and how it's changed everything. Like, if it's you don't know what category, you know. Instead of having a bird book, she's going online and looking up.
Well,
it's wild.
I think there's an app for phones now, too, that you can like put it up and a bird call and it'll tell you what bird that is.
It's the technology is just racing ahead of the knowledge of it. It's wild.
John is giving us a call from East Dennis. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
I subscribe to eBird Alerts, which sends birds, observers, sightings online to members. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that occasionally the sighting is identified as labeled confirmed, perhaps by the administrator of the site, which I think might be Cornell Labs. But it's not that frequent. And it doesn't seem to be based on the credentials of the observer, because even your esteemed guest doesn't always get it confirmed next to his posting. So I'm just curious, what is the criteria?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. And I actually, I know all the people at eBird that run it nationally. And each state has, of course, most of the eBird people are all volunteers. And whenever a sighting from Eastern Massachusetts come in, the gentleman that does that is Mr. Jeremiah Trimble, who happens to be unless you attach photographs of birds, which they are now enabled, there's a way to do it. I have unable to figure it out. If you put photographs and they can see you're reporting something that's not supposed to be here, and there's the picture of it, that would be confirmed. So unless they saw it or they've seen pictures of it, it's going to remain unconfirmed for maybe a week or so. And then by the time it's confirmed, there's already new sightings that have come in that show unconfirmed again. So it's a little misleading. I wouldn't put too much stock in those eBird reports. They're honing this. It's getting better. Soon soon some observers, if they see something, it should probably just go as confirmed because mm-hmm. they have a track record for mm-hmm. 30 or 40 years and they've seen, you know. And if somebody has just started birding and they report a Eurasian cuckoo, well, there's only been one of those in 100 years, and maybe they didn't see that. So don't take – I know people that get mad when they see their thing is unconfirmed. I laugh when I see mine unconfirmed because
you don't know how to attach the photo is why.
But then that means you have to have a photo of everything.
Right.
And some birds you're not going to be able to get photos of. It's just that will be – that keeps getting refined. eBird is getting better. I'm actually kind of a fan now. I wasn't initially, but they've turned me from the dark side.
All right, John, thanks for the question. Appreciate that. Joan is giving us a call from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I have two quick stories. On the 12th of May, I was out on the deck, and two hummers were chasing each other around. And then all of a sudden, they plunged down into the rose bush by the dog's run, and it turned out it was a male and a female, and they breathed down there.
Cool.
And
cool.
I wasn't being a voyeur, but I just accidentally saw it. And
That's
but I haven't seen
see.
Her since. He flew off right away after his business was done, and she sat there looking a little bit surprised, and then a squirrel came towards her, and then she left. And I haven't seen her, but I've seen him around a lot. He's in at the Hummer feeder every day. And then on the 17th, the raccoon was up on the deck after the peanut butter feeder, and while she was up here eating, a tufted titmouse kept landing on her side and pulling on her fur. And she'd look down at the tufted titmouse, and then the tufted titmouse would fly a few feet away. And then when she got back to feeding, the tufted titmouse would land on her.
She lined her nest with raccoon fur.
Oh,
cool.
Isn't that funny?
I mean, years ago, we used to have Siberian huskies, and they molt like crazy in the spring. And the yard, the house, everything was full of husky fur, and all the chickadees were flying around here looking like they were bearded birds. They didn't have to land on the huskies. The huskies just flew off them.
Do you have a lot of oak trees in your yard?
Yeah, I do have quite a few oak trees. I've got pitch pines. I've got a few locusts. I've got white pines.
Yep. I'm willing to bet that female hummingbird is sitting on a nest in your yard, or the eggs have hatched.
Uh-huh.
And it's likely to be 20 to 30 feet up at a fork on one of the lower branches in the oak tree. Of course, it's really small.
Yes.
But if you watch the male, mm-hmm. what's going to happen when those young hatch is the male and the female both are going to go out and catch spiders and insects to feed them. If you can follow him around for a little while, I bet you'll find out the location of the nest.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah. Check that out. Get some binoculars and just sit out there and for the long run until you find it.
All right.
Okay, good.
Good
Joan,
luck.
Joan, thanks for the call. Florence is giving us a call from Mattapoisett. Hi, Florence.
Good morning. I called a couple of years ago because I had a problem with house sparrows, common house sparrows, just inundating my home, nesting behind shutters.
Oh.
And the advice was to get the shutters as flush to the house as I could. So I did that last year, no dice.
They like it even better?
Pardon?
They like it even better with the shutters up tight, do they?
Yeah, they did. I had about six nests.
Wow.
So I took shutters down this year. It seemed like it was worth the effort. I fixed two holes in the eaves of my barn. I put duct tape over the vent to my oven. And I solved all those spots, but now I hear their undeniably squeaky little chirpings. And I have an arborvitae hedge around my yard, and my first question is, would they nest in arborvitae? And secondly, if now I went looking for that nest to get rid of it, would there be eggs in it, or might there even be hatchlings in it?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Mm.
I was just over in Spain in a little while ago, and house sparrows there are wild birds. They actually are part of, and they nest in all sorts. They don't nest like they do here in cavities and stuff. They actually nest in trees. I've had a palm tree with over 800 nests in it. It's just, it's crazy where they'll nest. And I have seen them nesting now in evergreens, particularly arborvitaes. Yeah, I would say, like, even the osprey nest in most places, the ospreys are nesting, and the house sparrows have built. There's probably 10 to 12 pairs of house sparrows breeding underneath the ospreys in their stick nest. So
I'm a few miles from the nearest osprey nest, so that's a good thing. But
They chase away the nice songbirds.
Again, this is another bird that was introduced into North America. Actually, house sparrows and European starlings are the only two birds in Massachusetts and federally that enjoy no state or federal protections. They're considered basically a winged rat. So there is no, I mean, people, I know not that nobody wants to do that. I have a bunch of birdhouses up where I am on Nantucket, and I just had a couple of house sparrows nesting in them for the first time in a long time. And I just removed a couple of nests that were built. They make a big bulky nest. They fill the entire box. And there were a couple of eggs on one of them, and I just took the nest out. I've seen the thing about house sparrows that I really object to the most is that they will go into a bird like an eastern bluebird or a tree swallow or a tufted titmouse or a white-breasted nuthatch nest, and I've seen them go in, kill the babies that are in there, and build a nest over the rotting corpses of the native birds. Mm. And that, when you see that, it's so upsetting. that it really, I'm not a big fan of house sparrows at all.
Yeah.
You know?
So, Florence, I'm
so you do what you have to
sorry,
do with them.
Florence,
for good luck.
So yeah. no moral dilemma if I find this nest.
Well, that's
get
that's,
rid of it, whatever stage.
I mean,
at.
You can't. We're not going to be able to control house sparrow numbers. Yeah. It's interesting though; they're becoming quite rare in England. Their numbers are
Which
crashing
where, they were,
where they're
yeah.
native to.
Wow.
But we're, I mean, all I can do here is try to keep them out of the boxes I put up because I don't want them killing the birds that I have in there. So.
Florence, good luck. Sorry.
Yep.
I've had the same
problem.
I don't
have any
it's
good news,
fun.
I'm
yeah.
afraid.
All right. Thanks for the call, Florence. David is calling from Nantucket. Hi, David.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good.
The answer to your bird brain quiz.
Okay, yeah.
I believe are fecal sacs.
Yay. Yeah,
right.
You got it.
Got
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Right,
I've recently read that occasionally the mother will actually dispose of these little diapers by taking them out of the nest and dropping them into privileged people's swimming pools. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I've seen that happen, actually. Yes, yeah, so the baby birds, amazingly, if you think about four little birds in a nest, and they get fed constantly, and then they have to excrete stuff. If they... The birds, miraculously, or it had to happen, evolved to basically the birds excrete their waste in a little diaper. They don't have to go get Huggies at the store. And it comes, and you see the adults, usually about every time, if you watch a nest, every third feeding, they come in and they dig around underneath. They pick up, you'll see them fly off with this fecal sac
and
fly a good distance away from the nest and drop it. But well, think about it. It would only not only would it foul the baby birds trying to grow feathers and could cause all sorts of problems, infection, and they wouldn't stay water. There's all kinds of things. But it also, all that waste around the nest would be a huge scent attraction to predators, things that can smell, especially dogs, foxes, skunks, raccoons. And birds are never more vulnerable than they're most vulnerable when they're at the nest site because a bird depends on its wings. Flee to live another day. If a predator's coming, you either lose the nest or you lose the adult. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of great things about fecal sacs, but young birds have like built-in diapers. Mm-hmm. It comes out in this little membrane. All of a sudden, they fly off. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Good
David,
work,
good,
David.
Good, good, good. I thought somebody might get that. Thanks, David, for calling and playing along with us.
Welcome. Can I ask Vern a quick question?
Sure, absolutely.
Or am I limited to just one?
No, go ahead.
Vern, I recently, just the other day, I saw a beautiful little mourning dove on the porch, very close and seemingly too close to my window, and he or she turned around in circles, looked quite sort of unnatural what the bird was doing, and then along comes the partner to the mourning dove, and they go through a very amorous ritual that ended up in their mating. The next day... there was what appeared to be a fledgling who had just left the nest of the mourning dove with these two, the very same doves. And the dove was a little too inexperienced in the flight department until the mother actually sort of got the bird going, and then it flew off. But my question is, do they have one bird in the nest, and then as soon as that bird is grown old enough to fly, they then create another egg for the nest?
That's a great question. The bird that was on the deck performing, there are some plumage differences between male and female mourning doves. So if you look at them, the male has like this bluish sheen and they're a little different. Mourning doves make a really, really poor, really badly constructed nest out of twigs. And I've never seen a worse nest for a bird, and a lot of times the eggs will even fall out.
Mm.
They generally lay 3 to 4 eggs, and the baby mourning doves are crazy. Pigeons feed their young with what they call this pigeon's milk. They eat stuff, and then they come and they regurgitate. They're very different birds. But mourning doves are also multi-brooded, so... if you saw only one chick, they fledged one, and those adults were re-nesting, obviously. And that bird, once that bird fledges and flies, it's on its own, and it sounded like the adults were going to start laying eggs again in another nest. Or they generally do not use the same nest ever. They'll build one nearby. But so I think what you saw was the end of the first batch. Where at least maybe they fledged more, and that was the last one to leave that you saw. And they were going to start re-nesting. So you're a very observant observer.
Yeah, David, thanks for the call. You know, with the pigeons, before they have feathers, they are really funny looking. But you wouldn't say that's a pigeon.
You wouldn't even know. It looks like some kind of
prehistoric thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're very weird looking little birds.
You can see how they might be dinosaurs.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it looks like a dinosaur baby. Ned is calling from Mashpee. Hi, Ned.
Hello.
Hi.
Morning.
How's it going? Hey, I have a question regarding green herons. We're located on Sequonset Island in Mashpee, and early summer, I noticed a green heron fly up into a big scrub pine that we have, and I thought that was weird. I've never seen one up in a tree, and he hopped up and he went up into a little nest. So we kept an eye on him, and there were four chicks that we got a chance to watch grow up last summer, hop around from branch to branch, and it was really neat to see. And we got here this year and looked up into the tree and didn't see anything, and we were wondering if the green herons come back, and we just noticed this morning that there is a nest up there and that there is a green heron.
Wow.
The question is in 50 years that the family has been down here, there's never been a green heron nest, and now it's 2 years in a row. Is that something we can anticipate and expect to come back? They find a good space and they want to continue?
Well, green herons are great. They actually came back late this year, at least the ones I'm privy to seeing every year. They arrived almost 2 weeks later than they normally do. So it didn't surprise me that you didn't find the nest right away. If the birds are successful nesting the year before, there's almost, you know, why wouldn't you go back and nest there? Mm-hmm. Obviously, everything was perfect if they can pull off young. If something had happened to the young or the nest was predated or they were unsuccessful, they would probably move on and try somewhere else. But since they had success, let's knocking on wood here, let's hope that they are able to raise and fledge young there again. And for this foreseeable future, as long as that where they're nesting is fairly protected and secluded, I would guess, where the birds are. Is the nest not near a house or anything? Is it across some water? Or are you still there?
This is a summer cabin. So
perfect.
Often we're not here, and they built the nest before we got here.
Mm. Right.
So and last year it was the same situation, and they decided this was safe. We weren't a threat to them, and they stuck around, and we got to see four chicks grow up.
Oh,
yeah, 'cause they're great looking birds.
Oh,
I mean, they're
awesome.
Really terrific.
Yeah, Ned, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you can expect them to be there until, you know, hopefully for the foreseeable future.
Right.
Excellent.
All right. Pat is calling from Dennis. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Vern just answered a question I had, which was the return of black-crowned night herons. They seemed incredibly late this year. Either I just wasn't there at the right time at the mouth of the Herring River there in North Harwich.
Yeah, no, you're right. Everything was slow this year to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Things are a couple weeks behind.
Mm-hmm. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
But listen, I'm actually calling. I called once before about the osprey nest up at the East Ham Rotary there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you know that there is a second pair just sort of practicing carrying sticks around and practicing courting and stuff on a couple of poles away?
A couple of housekeepers. Now, those are teenagers.
they're sort of
next year, they will probably, hopefully, there was a pair doing that over, generally, once they start housekeeping, if they can survive migrating back to South America and returning next spring, that pair that you're watching will probably do it in earnest next year. There might be two nests there.
That's what I was hoping. I just didn't know if you knew that other pair was there.
That's generally what happens. I actually haven't been by there in a while. I'm going by there next weekend, so I'll check it out. Thank you.
Yeah, Pat, thanks for the phone call.
Swing on the little road called Jones Road and sort of looking back down the power lines towards the other nest.
You'll see
on one of the first posts.
All right, thanks, Pat. Thanks for the call. Let's talk to Meg calling from Chatham. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question about catbirds. For about 25 years, the catbirds have returned, and they come to the railing off my deck and eat raisins and would eat from my hand. But this year, I haven't even seen one.
Oh. Well, they also were very late in returning, and it's possible your catbirds in Chatham just got in the last week or so. So you might hear them, and when they get here this late, they're already... You know what they sound like in the morning when they sing and at dusk again?
I'm not too familiar with
them. Yeah, I'm willing to bet you've got them. They probably skipped. If when they get here early, there's very little food available, so they really they look for raisins and feeders, and they'll even come eat out of your hand on the raisins.
Yes,
but this year, I think they got there so late that they were feeling the pressure, and the female's probably already incubating eggs, and they sort of skipped that part this year of hanging out. They usually get here a little early, and they're looking for food, which is why they would find the raisins that you so perfectly
so
put
Meg
out.
Meg should keep her eyes open because they're around.
Yeah, right? I bet your birds are nearby. They just, because they got here so late, their behavior was a little different.
Meg, thanks for the call. We got to get
to. I hope they haven't forgotten me.
No, I know. They'll be back.
I'm sure they did.
Before we run out of time, we got to talk about the bird song of the month. This month, we're talking about the killdeer, correct?
The bird song of the month.
Yeah.
So
let's take a listen.
Love that.
What's he saying?
Kill thee.
Is that a typical call?
That's the call you hear most often, at least I hear most often. Killdeers are they're a large plover. They're beautiful birds. If you're not familiar with them, dig out a book or go online, put a killdeer. So plover's got two big breast bands, two black bands right across its white breast. They're very common and widespread across all of North America. This is like the only plover. They nest on golf courses and gravel pits. They're not really that common on the Cape and Islands, but we have them. They nest in cemeteries. Mm. They nest on ball fields.
And we have a lot of great photos, Vern, that you have taken on our website, capeandislands.org.
Yeah, I put some pictures up of some babies that couldn't fly and killed it. They're pretty cool.
And we would love to hear your thoughts on Bird News, our pilot program here we're testing out. Do you think it should be a weekly program? You can send us an email, birdnews@wgbh.org. You can leave a message on our listener line, 508-548-9600, extension 103. You can also visit our website, capeandislands.org. Bird News is under the programs tab in case you missed it, any part of it. There's also a link to our Facebook page. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Until next time, keep your eyes to the sky.
Bird News is produced by Amy Vince with production assistance from Steve Junker and Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music is Harvest Time by Mike Marshall and Chris Thiele and is courtesy of Sugar Hill Records. Bird News is a production of WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH Radio.